Thank you very much. Good evening. First of all, can I say it's really lovely to be here. I was in Kilkeel a few weeks ago. I can't actually remember what week it was. To be quite honest, we've been so busy. And we're in this old Beetle doing a God Smuggler on tour around three schools here. And it really is an old Beetle. It's 42 years old. And it's kind of, once you get it going, keep it going. And when you get up to 60 in third gear, you've made it. And you just keep going. I drove it that day from Macrofelt, would you believe, straight down to Kilkeel. I'll never forget it in my life. I'll tell you, it really improves your prayer life. But it's wonderful to be here, and I want to thank Jill for all that she does as a church rep here. And we're only two staff, so we obviously work a lot with volunteers. We couldn't manage without them, so thank you so much, Jill. And of course, behind every good woman, there's a good man, isn't there? So I want to thank her husband as well for all of the support that he gives. And the Reverend Johnson, for your very warm welcome. Just as soon as I came in the door, I felt really welcomed here. So thank you so very much on your kind invitation to come. You know my name. I come from Donaghadee originally, and I don't know about you, but maybe we're just like this in Donaghadee, but we tend to be a wee bit nosy, and when speakers come to our church, we want to know something about them. So I'll tell you something very, very briefly. You know where I'm from. I haven't always lived there. In fact, I couldn't actually tell you the last time I lived in Donaghadee, but I still go to church there in Shore Street Presbyterian. I've always gone there except for 3 years of my life where I lived in Croatia. Beautiful country. I worked with a little Baptist church there. Prior to that, I was living and working in Dungannon, but stayed with my home church, which meant to be a bit of travelling, but that was okay. And my heart is mission. And for those young people, I led the youth group, and I wanted to get them involved in missions. So we signed up for a team to go to Croatia, which sounded quite nice as well, with evangelical ministries, and away we went for 2 weeks. It was just after the war out there. So it was kind of hard because we were refugees. We did a lot of building work, a lot of humanitarian aid, kids' clubs, the usual stuff you do in teams. And I came back waiting for these young people to be called by God to go into mission. And it must have been about, I don't know, a few months later. And I got a phone call from Mishko, the pastor, and he said, I wanted to chat to you. Would you come back as a church worker? I said, no. That wasn't the plan, sorry. I was really young people. I was far too old. And he said, no, seriously, have a think about it. So I thought about it. I prayed about it. And I left my job as complaints manager in Dungannon and went to Croatia and lived and worked there with that little Baptist church for 3 years. And while I was there, we helped a few of the young people who were there at the Bible College, and there's a young couple I was really particularly interested in and helped them. And they invited me to her home. It was in a village about 2 hours' drive away for dinner one night as a bit of a thank you. So away we tiddled along in this, again, I seem to pick up old bangers, but this old banger of a car, and away we went. Beautiful night. We had dinner at her parents' house, and we went out for a walk in the park. And as we were walking through the park, there was a couple that came towards us. And as they came closer into an area where they could probably recognise us, they moved and they walked over to the other side of the road. And I really, to be quite honest, never thought anything more of it until Mario turned around and asked me, did I notice it? And I said, yes, I did. He said, they're my parents. He said, when he was 17, he became a Christian. He was 22 when I met him. And he said, when I became a Christian, they threw me out of the house. And I haven't talked to them since. And then he said this, I meet my 10-year-old brother in secret. I couldn't believe it. This was Croatia. I was totally, totally shocked. At that time, I knew about the persecuted church, but I wasn't very involved with it. I came back 3 years later, back into my job in the health service, and I knew I wasn't where God wanted me to be. And I started to pray, if I can use the words, that somehow God would open up doors. And I ended up in Open Doors working with Douglas Mark, many of you would know. And I worked with Douglas for a few years as a part-time. Didn't make any sense because 2 days before I just signed for a new house, new to me, and a mortgage. And I'd just been offered a job 15 hours a week. But I really believed with all my heart it was right. So into that job I went. 7 years later, whatever happened along the journey, I'm heading up the ministry. still in contact with Douglas, learnt a lot, and he taught me so much in all of those years, and I'm very, very thankful for his ministry. So that's my little journey, and that's where I am today. And I want to say thank you. Some of these guys were telling me as well, you were up at the Rend concert. I want to thank you for your support in that. For us, that was total nightmare because there are two staff trying to organise this and we were just so nervous. We loved it when it arrived, but the whole logistics of it, but a wonderful night. So I want to thank you and your support in that and all those little ways that you support through your prayer, through your giving, all sorts of ways. It really, I want to assure you, it really, really makes a difference. So I'm going to take you on a little journey tonight across some countries in the world, just two. I want to say to the guys up above, I'm not going to show the DVD. I've changed my mind. Sometimes we think on our feet. There are too many younger kids. I just don't think it's appropriate. But I'd really encourage the adults to please go on to our webpage and look at the video that says Save Syria. There's a bit of gunfire and stuff in it, so it's not maybe as good to show here tonight. But please look at it. It just gives you the real picture of what believers are living in that situation. You know the countries, Jill prayed through some of them there, that we work in. That little map shows you the top 50 countries in the world. And we're working there, serving the persecuted church. And North Korea is still number one. We really believe with all our hearts one day those walls will be broken down and one day that country will be free. But at the minute, it's been number one for 11 years as the hardest place on earth to be a believer. I want to read you this little blog. I'm quite into blogs sometimes. And there's one, if we turn on to the next slide, one that turned up on the page, and here goes. A young couple move into a new neighbourhood. The next morning, while they're eating breakfast, the young woman sees her neighbour hanging her washing out on the line. That laundry isn't very clean. She doesn't know how to wash it correctly, she said to her husband. Perhaps she needs better laundry soap. Her husband looked on and he was just silent. But every time her neighbour was hanging out her washing to dry, the young woman still made the same comments. A month later, though, when she looked out, she was really surprised because when she looked, she saw that the clothes were so clean and fresh. And she said to her husband, I wonder who taught her this. I wonder who taught her how to clean. Her husband replied, I got up early this morning and I cleaned our windows. But you know, so it is with life, isn't it? When you look at the persecuted church, I wonder what window you're looking through. When the news comes on at night, when the news comes on at 6 o'clock, our screens are just filled with countries, persecuted countries, where there is so much violence going on at the moment. And I wonder what you see. I want to read this little quote from Brother Andrew. He said this, Brother Andrew, who started Open Doors all those years ago. Every day in the news, we are reading about the major upheaval in the Arab world. People are rising up in protest. Dictators are being toppled and elections are being held. All of this creates uncertainty for the church. On the one hand, there are forces that would attack and destroy the church. On the other, there are historic opportunities for the advance of the gospel. I urge you to pray fervently with your brothers and sisters throughout the Arab world. Every time you see the news from Egypt or Syria or another Arab nation, remember there's a church there and they need our prayers. And there are churches in those very situations. We'll go on to the next slide. In March, I went to Egypt. I've been there a couple of times, going back out in the summer. This time when I went, I would have to say I was totally shocked. I hadn't been for about 3 years. And when we went, this is what we saw. This is in Tahrir Square, and these are the tents. The protesters are still there. Okay, next one. And the walls. This is the end of the street that I'm going to show you that we were at a Presbyterian church. In Cairo, they have the biggest Presbyterian church in the whole of that nation. And that's at the end of the street. Normally we could have walked through there. Now it's all barricaded up and that's all you can see. Okay. But can we go on to the next one? Sorry. This is the church in Cairo. And that church, absolutely fantastic church. Thousands of people there go there every Sunday. They also go during the week. You have to remember you're an Islamic country, so the church is open, there are services at all different times during the week. And that church is very strategic in there. But it's surrounded by really tall buildings, and there's a reason for that. When they built the church, the government said, you can have your church, but we don't want people to go there. We don't want you to reach out to people. We don't want people to become Christians. So what the government decided to do was surround it with really tall buildings. So if you or I were a visitor and didn't know where the church was, you probably would have problems trying to find it. But that church in the centre of Cairo is alive. And it is serving, it is reaching out, and many, many people are coming to faith. And we'll go to the next slide. That's one of the, maybe I should try and work this, should I? That is one of the stained glass windows in it. Oh, this works, that's okay, I'll fire ahead. What they did before the revolution, they really felt challenged, they really felt God was speaking to them, that they should be praying for their nation, that they should be praying for Egypt. And this particular verse came to them time and time again from Psalm 34. And they prayed into it, and they had prayer meetings every Monday night they meet. And we went to one of their prayer meetings. Do you know how many people turned up at that prayer meeting? A regular prayer meeting on a Monday night. 3,000. And we sat in that prayer meeting for absolutely hours. And one of the things that I was so challenged by, they pray for Ireland. They pray for the UK. Couldn't believe it. In that nation, praying for us. And this is inside the church. You can see the people. But in the church, they have to be really careful, because not only are there these people, there are also people who are secret, secret police who come, secret spies who come in to see who the believers are so as they can suss out who's who. And this is just another photograph of the people praying. And then when you're in Cairo, I don't know if anybody's been to it or to Garbage City. And in Garbage City, there's a church there again, alive and growing. And in Garbage City, really the rubbish from the whole of Cairo, from millions of people, comes into this place. And the Christians who are there, the believers, they sort it out, and that's how they earn a living. Because these people are just so poor. And for Christians in Egypt, if you grew up in a Christian faith, if you came from a Christian family, part of the problem is discrimination. You will not see many Christians, or any in fact probably, in professional jobs high up on the scale. You will see them in the lower jobs all the time. They are discriminated against. And for Muslims then, to come into an area like this where believers are, it's unclean because of the animals and everything else in. So the believers in here are relatively safe. But the church, the Presbyterian church I showed you, they go into this area. They send in teams to hold Bible studies with these young people, with older people, with communities. And as you drive round it and you drive to the very top, you're met with this. And this sign is into the cave church. And in that cave church, they too cried out to God for their community. They also had a prayer meeting. And here's their prayer meeting. I don't know if you've seen it on YouTube. Go on to it. It's Sat7 videoed it. Unbelievable. How many people... Do you talk? Do you talk here in Kilkeel? Yeah? Good. Good. How many people do you think turned up to their prayer meeting? For a 24-hour prayer meeting. Go on, take a guess. 70,000 people turned up to pray, to cry out to God for their nation. We stood in March in that cave church, been to it a couple of times, an amazing place. Engraved right round the wall are different Bible stories, an absolutely wonderful place to stand in. We actually stood in that. It was empty the night we went because there are two caves. We were in the other one as well. There was a service there. But this one was empty, and we stood there and we sang and we prayed and we cried. We actually stood there and did that over this nation, over these people. And God answered the prayers that they were praying for their people. And when the revolution started, the church that I showed you, the Presbyterian church, was in the centre of Cairo, not very far from Tahrir Square. So all the trouble started. What were they to do as a church? What was the situation that they found themselves in? I'm not going to read all of this story, and it's going to seem like a strange one maybe to read for persecuted church, but it's a story of feeding the 5,000, and I'm going to take it from John chapter 6. I'm going to jump in at verse 5. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test them, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" And you know, that church could have said back to God in their prayers, "Who are we? What can we do here? This is all we have." And in that church are secret believers who are people who have come from the Muslim faith into Christianity. They're sitting in that situation. They're certainly sitting with a lot of believers, but they're also sitting with great need. And like the disciples in that, they could have turned around and said, "You know something, it's not our problem. Send the people away. Let them go to the hospitals. Let them go somewhere else." But they didn't, because they really believe God was challenging them. And that photograph shows you what they did was the courtyard of their church they opened up to be a hospital. And men and women, doctors, men and women came. Female doctors, male doctors came and worked together. Not only male and female, but Muslim and Christian doctors came in there and worked, trying to save lives. Young people and adults went out in motorbikes, they went out in bicycles, they went out in what mode of transport they could find, and they brought in the sick and injured, and they set up a hospital there. What a witness that was. And one particular night, in the middle of all this mayhem, later on there was like a lull, and there was silence, and the place had gone quiet. And the young people that night were having their prayer meeting. There were 300 to 400 young people in that church meeting. And as they were meeting and as they were praising God and this lull happened, across the air came the music of them singing, "Jesus is Lord." And the doctors and the nurses who had been treating the patients in the middle of this situation, in this lull, they got up and they went inside and they stood with them and together they prayed and worshipped God. God was answering their prayers and God was using them. This is the courtyard now. That was it in March. And if you look, I think you should be able to see at the very right, you can see still the stretchers and the oxygen there. But you know, there's poverty in that country. We pass these little boats and this is home. This is home for some of these people. There's a very, very difficult situation to go on. And I could say particularly for girls, because they are so afraid, and this picture just depicts it, they're so afraid that the Sharia law will come into place in that country, which means that everybody must be of the Muslim faith. And or obey the Muslim rules, I should say, rather than be a Muslim. So this is going to be really difficult for Christians. But in this Presbyterian church still are believers. And when we were there, I talked to a lady and she said, she's a pastor's wife and she was knocked down a few weeks earlier. And the reason she was knocked down, because she stands out as being a believer, because she doesn't wear the Muslim dress, obviously. And they saw her. And a car came back and passed and just clipped her for no other reason than that. Talk to people who aren't being served in shops. People just who are really, really suffering in many different ways as believers. But the biggest problem probably is for these people. And when you and I would look at this lady, we would see a Muslim. When we were in that church, it was Sunday morning we were in it, and the lady came in the side door dressed exactly like this. And she took off the burqa and she stepped inside and she just looked like you and I worshipping there. And she was a secret believer. I'm going to tell you a story of one, and it isn't her, a story of another lady who also became a Christian. And what happens is many of these Muslims are searching for meaning, they're searching for hope, they're searching for peace, they're searching for something different. And many are lifting the Bible and trying to find out what Christians believe so they can persecute them. And what's happening is they're finding Jesus. Many of them are finding Jesus. And through satellite dishes, satellite television, radio programs, and they're turning to Christ. But there's a cost involved, particularly for Muslims. Because if a Muslim becomes a Christian, it is an honor in their faith for the family to kill them. And it's as simple as that. So many of them are being tortured, they're being beaten, many are on the run, and many of them are secret believers. But this particular lady, she comes to the church, the Presbyterian church. And when she came in, she started to learn more and more, and she wanted to serve God. And she asked them in the church, how can I serve? I want to do something to serve God. And I thought, you know, what on earth could this woman do? Because she cannot, she's hiding her faith outside, and she still has to because it's so dangerous. So they said she could lift the offering. And she was so excited, so she did that. And she took the plate round each Sunday until one particular Sunday, and she was upstairs in the gallery. And as she was passing the plate round, she handed it to this gentleman, and he grabbed her arm. And he looked into her eyes, and she recognised him from her apartment block, and she recognised him as being a Muslim, and she knew that he was. And remember that there are people, I said, that come into the church to spy, to see who the Christians are. And as he gripped her hand, as she had that plate, he looked at her and he said to her, are you a believer? Now, if you think for one moment in that situation, in the middle of Cairo, what would you do? Particularly a woman, what would you do? And she had a choice to make in those few seconds, and I'm sure her world was falling apart right round her. And her decision was, number one, did she say no and deny Jesus? Or number two, did she say yes and take a risk? And with any decisions we make in life, with choices we make, of course there's also a consequence, and there was going to be for her. And as she looked into her eyes, she probably was shaking. She probably went as white as a sheet. And she turned around to him and said, yes, I am a believer. And then he looked at her. And he said these words to her, if you don't tell, neither will I. What had happened? He too had become a believer. He too had been tending the church secretly, and that was the first time they had met, the two of them. God is doing amazing things in this world, in Egypt, and there's hope in the midst of everything we see on television. When you see it on again, please, it was on just there a couple of days ago, please pray for those people, pray for those believers, and pray for that church in the middle of that situation. Oh, sorry, that's the mosque. I was going to show you that we visited. And we visited and we went around, and in the mosque we were given loads of leaflets because they're trying to reach out to people. They're evangelizing as well, and they're wanting people to come to Islam. And when we went in there, we did a prayer walk right around it. We prayed and prayed as we went around over those people. Syria is on the news. These pages or photographs are flashing through our television screens again and again. Refugees, absolutely dreadful situation that we see there before our eyes. People living in these refugee camps, and just horrendous, horrendous situation as you see it. I don't know if you saw news at 10 last week. It was on Monday night, absolutely horrific. Women and children, adults. I actually had to switch it off, I'm being honest. It was horrendous. We have a web page at the minute that is called Save Syria, and we have this campaign on, and we're asking people to sign up to pray. We're also going to present a petition, which I've left in the hall, a petition to the United Nations to say they need to do something about these people. They need to have freedom for their religion. And that night, our web page crashed after that news, because people went on. Our situation, our open doors wasn't on the news, but people had heard about it, and they went on, and we had to spend the next day building up the web page. But isn't it wonderful that believers are standing, Christians in this country are standing with these people, and I'd really, really encourage you to do that. Homs, I'm going to read a couple of little bits from it. I'm not quite sure what time. Am I okay? The situation in Syria is scary, the news said, disturbing new evidence of intimidation and persecution of Christians in the city of Homs. Just the destruction and everything there. I'm going to give you a couple of figures. According to the latest figures, the United Nations Commissioner for Refugees, the number of internally displaced persons in Syria is over 2 million. That's more than the population of Northern Ireland. More than our population displaced. It has left over 70,000 people dead. The situation is difficult at its best, said the Open Doors spokesman. Homes are easily confiscated. The Christian community is the only group that doesn't fight back. It doesn't protect its property with guns. So when the rebels are searching for somewhere to take, over, they're taking the homes of Christians. But in the middle of this situation, we are doing something, and the church is doing something, and it's reaching out to those people. This is the time for the church, the pastor says in that video. This is the time for the church to reach out, the church to rise up. And in their situation, they got a gift. Their first gift came through from two people. One was from £2 and one was for £3. They had £5 to spend. £5 to reach out to the community around them that was so much desperate need. People that had what they were standing up in. They had no beds to sleep in. They had no clothes. They had no food. They had absolutely nothing. And with that £5, they prayed and prayed to God. And that's why I picked that Bible passage, because they prayed through the story of feeding the 5,000. And they prayed, Lord, we have £5. We have nothing else. We give it to you to multiply. And a bit like Egypt, a bit like the story of feeding the 5,000, the disciples, they could have closed their eyes to it. They could have just fitted in and sorted out their little community in the church. And they believed, no, that God was asking them to reach out. That same church is now feeding and looking after over 1,600 families. God did take what they had. God multiplied it. We've come alongside them and we're working with them. How are we doing it? Providing aid. Providing what these people need, and many of them are asking for Bibles, and also providing Bibles and sending them into those situations. And this is going out day by day. The churches are overwhelmed by the amount of need, and at one of the churches was actually ready to call the police because they didn't know how to cope, but they didn't. And God used them in that place to be a light. This family, one of our staff was out in Damascus, visited this family, and they sat, but they sat around families and they tried to help these families. And there's a little television in the room they were in, and there were about 17 or 18 people sleeping in this one room. Television was still working, the people were keeping in touch with the outside world as to what was going on in their country. And then this came on the news. And it was a report of this man crying over his two sons who were dead. And this man looked over and he said, "There, that's my cousin." And it was his family that were on the news. And that is what these people are facing day by day. Kids that have no homes, they don't know where they're going to sleep. They don't even know if they're going to be there the next day. The situation is absolutely dreadful. And for many, that's it. Life has stopped. Life has just stopped because of the need. And then our contact again, he said this, "Without the church, Syria has no hope." A report from Open Doors says some areas in the city of Homs and Aleppo are being taken over by Muslim extremists who are implementing Sharia law. We need food and medicine, but what our country needs most now is prayer. We have no option than to turn to God in this desperate situation. The most important thing the world can do for us is pray. For many people, just like this woman, life has stopped. Many people are just numb. They have nothing. Absolutely nothing. This man, you can read the quote himself. "Many of the Syrian churches have been able, though, in the middle of all of this, to keep their doors open, and they continue to reach out to people. We're working alongside churches in many areas, and Damascus is one of them." Most of our work is with the Christians, the believers inside Syria, as they reach out to refugees, as they reach out to other people. No matter who these people are, they are reaching up with, out with the love of Jesus. And many of them are turning around and saying, "Why are you doing this?" And they're hearing about God. And lives are being transformed. One of the pastors said this, a Syrian pastor, "My people are hurting. I can cry like Nehemiah because the walls of our cities are burnt and the people are in great trouble and disgrace. I can weep like Jeremiah because of the intensity and the spread of evil. I can mourn like David because of the indiscriminate, brutal killing of innocent people, children, women, elderly, youth. In some areas, mothers are dressing their daughters in the hijab, the Muslim dress. to avoid them being raped. Please pray for our children. This little map we just put up on the webpage there the other day, and this is the places we're working in, the ones that are in bright orange. But people are saying, God has heard our cry. Prayers are being answered, and they're saying to the outside world, please, please, stand with us and pray for us. And that's what you can do. Pray, speak out, sign that petition that we're going to take. We're not going to take names to the United Nations. We're also going to take it to the European Parliament, but we are going to take numbers, figures, and it will make a difference, and of support, of course. And I really, again, want to say thank you for all the support that you're giving. I've travelled to several countries. I haven't travelled to this one. And when you see the difference that it makes, it's unbelievable. It really does make a difference, and God is working. We had a retreat a couple of months ago, and we brought a pastor from an area. I can't actually tell you what country he was from. We're not allowed to disclose that, but that doesn't really matter. But he said this sentence. I've never forgotten it. And he said, in his country, if you're caught with a Bible, you're in trouble. But if you're caught with two Bibles, you're seen to be a smuggler. Because why, in their mind, from the government, why would anybody want to have two Bibles? So they believe you're smuggling it. And we said to him, well, why do they think that? And here's what the authorities think in that country, or believe in that country, that one verse could change a nation. Now, if you think about it for a minute, think of the verse even we all know, for God so loved the world. And they believe it can change a nation. We desperately need to be praying in for those people that know one verse. And then Pastor said this, we feel connected to the outside world because we know that people are praying for us, and they're thanking us, and they're asking us to continue that. And then, what are they doing in Syria? Are they sit back and not praying? No, they're not. They actually have a chain now of 24-hour prayer going constantly in their country. That's the petition. Love you to sign it. If you sign up, we'll send you. It's not actually this wristband. It's a different one that says Save Syria, and we'll gladly post that out to you. Of course, you can support it. And Syria, we've put it like this, a church on its knees. Church on its knees, but it's also on its feet in action as a result of those prayers. So thank you so very, very much for giving me the time just to share a little bit about what's happening. But please hold on to that hope that God is working in those nations and prayers are being answered. Thank you.